Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Connor Cyrus.
And I'm Michaela Lafrac. We're in the midst of a food-rich time of year. It's hunting season, for one, which means many Vermonters have wild game in their fridges and freezers. Plus, it's almost Thanksgiving, and many of us, I know I am, are thinking about what to cook.
So today on Vermont Edition, we thought we'd bring some experts to talk about cooking with local ingredients, specifically wild game and foraged foods.
Joining us today is Kelly Noderman. She's with the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund and Vermont Farm to Plate. She's also an avid hunter, and her family owns Snug Valley Farm in East Hardwick. Hi, Kelly.
Hi there. How's it going?
Good.
We're also joined by Peter Bayless. He's a chef and forager based in South Rillington, Vermont. Peter, great to have you on Vermont Edition.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And last but not least, we're also joined by Jesse Lawyer. He's a Missisquoi Abenaki chef based in Burlington, and he's also the host of Vermont Wild Kitchen, a cooking show that you can find on Facebook Live. Hi, Jesse.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So, Jesse, let's start with you. Can you tell us what exactly foraging is?
Well, to me, foraging is, you know, like whether you're just on a hike or you're hunting or you're looking for raw materials to make something, it's the things that you gather along the way. So if you find, you know, like ramps or fiddleheads, you know, those are easy ones. For example, to me, foraging is you're not looking for one specific thing, but you're finding these things as you're going out and collecting them based on your needs.
Okay. And Peter, what about you? What does foraging mean to you?
Foraging to me is a way to kind of reconnect and kind of gain appreciation for where our food comes from and how we consume kind of affects the environment around us. Just spending some time in the woods and figuring out how certain mushrooms grow or vegetables grow really kind of gives you an appreciation, kind of shows you how food interacts with the environment and how our consumption of it affects the environment. So that's really what I think about a lot.
Now, Kelly, speaking of spending time in the woods, you know, I understand that you are an avid hunter. Let's talk a little bit about the sustainability piece that comes with hunting.
Yeah, I've been hunting since I was 12 years old. And it's a family tradition. And there's ways to be a sustainable hunter, I believe. I think the Fish and Wildlife does a great job at deciding how many animals you can take in a year. And in Vermont, obviously, it's not very much. So I did fill a tag on last Sunday, the second day of opening weekend. And that will be the only deer I get for the year. But that's the first time I've ever actually gotten a deer in the state of Vermont. I've always gotten them in Western New York, where I'm originally from. So I think it's really important, though, that, you know, we have the state entity that's able to look at with wildlife biologists what is going on in the state and what we need to take and not take.
And if I'm not mistaken, that was a 6-point buck you got. Is that correct?
Yes, it was 156 pounds, 6-pointer. Our freezer is now full.
So, congrats.
We're really excited.
And Kelly, I just want to stick with you for a little bit longer. So how do you, when it comes to, now that you have it, it's in the freezer, what do you do next?
Well, the first thing that we always do is the tenderloin is the best cut. It's the highest quality steak. So, you know, we get everything back. We actually had it professionally butchered by a friend of ours. And we get it all back and put it in the freezer, except for the tenderloin and some backstrap, which is another really great steak. And then cook it up in a cast iron pan with butter, a little bit of pepper, salt, and a touch of garlic. And heavy on the butter, and because it needs to add some fat because deer is really lean. So, but not to cook it, overcook it. And it's just delicious. It's better than any steak I ever had. And my husband's going to be upset with me because we have a grass-fed beef operation, but I personally really love deer meat. So I love venison. So, that's the best way to cook the tenderloin in my opinion, but I am not a professional chef like Jesse and Pete. So they might have a different opinion.
All right. And Jesse and Pete, we do want to hear from you about how you cook with venison. And listeners, we'd love to hear from you. What are your tips and tricks for cooking with wild game? You can call us at 800-639-2211 or email us at vermontedition@vpr.org. Now, Jesse, let's start with you. And I'm also going to pose my own personal cooking question to you. I made venison stew a couple weeks back, and it did not turn out very well. The venison just tasted really gamey and kind of dry. Can you give some tips for how to cook with venison in a way that makes it taste as rich as, say, beef or other meats that folks might be more used to cooking with?
First, I'd ask, how did you prepare it?
I think I like seared it for a little bit, and then I kind of just added it into a vegetable stew.
Got it. So it really depends on like the cuts you're using, you know, whether it's a deer, bear, moose, turkey, fish, you know, there's specific parts of the animal that you treat differently. So when you're doing a stew, you know, searing it first and foremost, that starts to build flavor in the meat. And with the tougher cuts, it's just about low and slow heat, letting them go for a long period of time, allowing that connective tissue to break down, you know, and adding aromatics and seasonings in there with it to really just like blend all the flavors together. And, you know, there's so many different cuts on a venison. There's a lot of meat there that you can just treat so differently, and then you can try new things with it. Some of my favorite cuts on the venison are the shanks, the tongue, and the heart. I love tenderloin, but to me, those kind of off cuts that people usually waste, that's what really intrigues me, and that's what I enjoy using and eating, because there's so much flavor and so much versatility with those pieces. Like, you can take the tongue, you can make pastrami from it, you can make corned beef, you know. Granted, it's not a huge piece of meat, and, you know, it doesn't feed a large person, but, you know, taking those unused pieces and creating something magical from them is what kind of gets my creative juices flowing.
Now, Jesse, I'm curious, you know, these unused pieces, how do you make them, I guess, accessible to people who might not have a very diverse palate?
So, I mean, one thing that I'm doing is I'm working with Vermont Fish and Wildlife and Shane Rogers on the Vermont Wild Kitchen meets the Dawnland Kitchen, which is my Instagram handle and kind of where I, you know, provide what I make to the indigenous community and whoever else happens to follow me. First and foremost, who my cooking is for is the Abenaki community and the broader indigenous community, and to also educate non-natives on our traditional food ways. But with working with Vermont Fish and Wildlife and Shane, one thing that I said is I want to take these off cuts and show people that, you know, don't throw them away. Don't throw certain cuts in the grind pile. Don't leave the heart with the gut pile. For those who can hunt moose, for example, don't get that moose mounted, you know, take that nose off and cook it. That nose is the most flavorful piece of wild game that I've ever had in my life.
All right, so I got it. How do you cook moose nose? What are your tips for that?
So traditionally it was seared in a fire, which burnt all the hair off, and then cooked low and slow. But that kind of leaves an astringent, you know, burnt hair taste on the meat, which, you know, some people really do enjoy. There's natives that still prepare it that way. How we prepared the moose nose was we boiled it for 4 hours, then peeled it, and then smoked it for another 4 hours. And you just get this beautiful caramelized mix of meat and tendon and fat. The fat is unlike anything you've ever had before. It's almost got the same chew as like a cheddar cheese, but the flavor of just this rich fat.
I'm so intrigued, but I do want to get to Peter and ask Peter, you know, as we discuss using, you know, foods that maybe are unused for other people, you know, some of that is I would consider to be some foraged foods. What are Vermonters foraging?
Right now we're doing, or we actually just wrapped up with mushrooms. There's still quite a few mushrooms out there that you can actually find, but mostly right now we've been doing sumac, cedar, mushrooms, and we saw a couple of butternuts this year. And then, and maybe some acorns. But I've mostly been focusing on mushrooms because this year was just a fantastic year for mushrooms with the season being extended a little longer and warmer. I mean, I just went out last weekend and I still found some mushrooms in the ground that I wouldn't normally have found around this time of year. So it's a lot of mushrooms.
And if you're a mushroom forager, we'd love to hear from you. You can call us at 800-639-2211 and tell us what you found and how you cook with it. And Pete, what are you making with some of these mushrooms? What are some of your favorite recipes?
Well, I found a puffball earlier in the season and I did a couple of different things with it. The first one I did like a kind of play on a BLT. I just wanted to kind of keep it subtle just so I could kind of get the flavor of the mushroom. And that was really interesting. It was kind of like subtle mushroom flavored tofu sandwich with a little bacon and tomato and lettuce there. I kept it really simple just so that the mushroom flavor would kind of come through. And then I also applied it to kind of a classic lasagna dish and tried it that way. And it was awesome. The mushroom flavor just kind of came right through. It brought a level of umami to the whole dish. So most of the mushrooms I like to keep really simple and just do a quick saute and turn them into like a quick condiment with a little vinegar and mustard and some fresh herbs.
That sounds delicious. Charles from Essex Junction just wrote us, and he said that the most important thing you can collect while foraging is the owner's permission, the landowner's permission. Jesse, can you talk a little bit about that, about balancing, foraging and exploring in the woods with making sure that you're kind of following land rights and respecting the owner's land?
I speak to it a little bit. I mean, the idea of land ownership is a very touchy subject, especially when it comes to indigenous rights and indigenous sovereignty. I mean, all across this continent, whether it's South America, North America, there was an indigenous population, whether inhabiting or using and respecting the land. And I mean, today, obviously, that it happened and we are where we are. And I mean, the beautiful thing about Vermont is that the land's not posted. You can go on it. They say it's always good to get the landowner's permission. I mean, if I'm looking for something, I'm usually, trying to gather a natural material, wood or birch bark, for example. I do have friends that let me use it for that purpose, so I already have it. But, I mean, I can't really speak to, I mean, if it's posted, obviously, I would say get out there and ask the landowner's permission. But I think land access, especially now, and with a lot of people from outer state coming in, buying up land and posting it, it would be wise to get landowner permission. But I believe in more accessible land access to everyone. And, I mean, there is a lot of state land where you can go and, I'm not sure the rules and regulations on foraging on state land, but, that would be the person going and doing that responsibility to research.
And Kelly, when it comes to land rights, it's obviously much different when you're hunting for big game, especially deer, because oftentimes things are posted. Will you walk us through the experience of knowing where and when to hunt?
Sure. And mine's a little nuanced. The land that I've been hunting on, because my farm, we pasture raise animals. So we do grass-fed beef. And so we lease other landowners' land for that purpose and then obtain permission. For me, it's more about, obviously asking the landowner for access. Especially if you're hunting with a gun, but mostly I think it's just really important that you know where other hunters are and hunter safety. I haven't had issues with that access. We also have our own home farm, which my husband has a spot on that farm. And then we offer access to a few different people during youth hunting so that they can try to get deer and teach their children the tradition of hunting. So I think, you know, being respectful of the land itself and then also of other hunters is really important. I grew up in a place where the land used to be very open and there wasn't issues with posting land. And then it became more of an issue as I got older. And now my family in Western New York has a lot less area to hunt on because of people posting land and then leasing it out to other people, allowing them to come hunting. So they're just leasing it for hunting purposes. And that's such a shame because it used to just be a really shared space where all the hunters respected each other. So I agree with there should be more access to land.
And Pete, I know that you're in South Royalton. Can you tell us a little bit about like what types of things that you find specifically in your area? And are there different parts of the state that are better for different foraged plants and ingredients?
Yeah, I found everything. I probably found about 30 different species, edible ones this year. So anything but like the classics, chicken in the wood, the puffball mushroom, chanterelles, oyster mushrooms, witch's butter, and ataki mushrooms, which is like enoki mushrooms. It's just the wild version. They look completely different. So I am really fortunate that I live in a very fertile area of woods, and that's kind of where I do most of my foraging. So I actually don't really go out of my area to do foraging. So I'm not sure what else is or where else would have good foraging, but I would assume that it's everywhere. I mean, I see mushrooms on my way into work and I pull over and I go and grab them and then go to work. So I wouldn't be surprised if they're everywhere.
And what's your advice for people who are interested in mushrooms but are kind of scared that they're going to eat something dangerous or poisonous?
I would approach it two ways. One would be to go out with somebody who knows what they're doing and has been eating mushrooms, someone like me, and hasn't gotten sick, and can really point out the subtleties, because it is kind of hard to explain to someone how not to eat a toxic mushroom without like really just showing them, smelling the mushroom, feeling it, looking for the texture, what tree is it growing underneath, because that can make a huge difference in terms of the species that you're identifying. The other piece of advice I would have, if you're not really comfortable foraging yourself, is to try to expose yourself a little bit. There's a lot of wild mushroom suppliers in Vermont that you can go and get lion's mane or shiitake mushrooms or wine caps and just kind of start there. And I think it'll kind of ignite a little more interest and you'll get more comfortable eating kind of this weird stuff and you'll kind of want to go from there.
Jesse, I want to ask you, what, if any, are the concerns that you have when it comes to accessibility and foraging? Because, you know, I don't think that a lot of people, I don't think it's very popular, even though it's how we all survived. So are there any concerns when it comes to education and foraging? Jesse?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, there we go.
Sorry, I got put back on hold. I would say first and foremost is know what you're looking at and, you know what you're going after so that you don't get sick, you don't pick the wrong thing.
Oh, Jesse, we might have lost you. Are you there? All right, we'll come back to that question. But we did just have a listener tweet that nothing tastes better than jellied moose nose, which we would love to hear more about from Jesse when we get him back on. We're also curious to hear more from you listeners about what types of you know, unique ways that you're preparing wild game or foods that you forage. We'd love to hear some recipe ideas ahead of Thanksgiving. Our number is 800-639-2211. You can also email us at vermontedition@vpr.org or tweet us at vermontedition. Jesse, we have you back. Do you want to start again? We were talking about accessibility and teaching people about foraging.
Okay, can you hear me this time?
Yes.
Perfect. Yeah, first and foremost, I would say is education. Know what you're going after. Know what you're looking for. Know what you're picking. There's a lot of people out there that are willing to teach. I usually keep what I'm gathering pretty simple and easy to, you know what you're doing. Yeah. And then what was the other part of the question?
Education when it comes to teaching people how to forage. And I guess my point was, it's like back in the day, this was like a normal way for people to get food. And we've really gotten away from that. So I'm wondering if there are ways, you know, I guess I'm just wondering what your concerns are from us getting away from how we forage.
So first and foremost, I would say you can't really have these conversations without first speaking with the indigenous peoples that were here, you know, whether it's Vermont or New York or out in California, Alaska, wherever. When it comes to, you know, local food, sustainability, foraging, hunting, all that, the indigenous voice should be first. You know, this was our original home, our land that we tended to, and, you know, our voices should be heard, especially as we're all starting to reclaim the foods that were lost. But with all that being said, I believe that everyone should have the knowledge to be able to go out and gather their own wild foods or to grow their own foods or to be able to hunt. And, you know, as much as I can, I'd like to help, you know, with that information, having the indigenous community come first.
Right. Now, Kelly, back to you. I'd love to hear a bit more about what you have been cooking in your own kitchen, particularly with wild game. Are there any recipes that you're particularly excited about that you've either done before or are looking forward to trying out this year?
I have a cookbook that my sister actually made of all of my mom's recipes. And my whole family hunts, my mother hunts, my grandmother hunted. So the cookbook is like simple stew recipes. And when Jesse talked earlier about the like cooking it low and slow, I like, you know, low crock potting a lot of my stew recipes. But my favorite, which I, every opening day, it's a tradition in my family where we crock pot basically a stew, and then we go out hunting all day and we come home and we have basically what's left of last year's meat, which we didn't have anything left. So we actually used some of our grass-fed beef. It's a hearty beef stew recipe. It's my favorite. It's like big, huge chunks of local potatoes, local carrots, like anything, like big chunks of your local vegetables. And then, you know, the stew meat in there and some tomatoes that you might've gotten from your garden. So it's a lot of things you might've homegrown or procured locally and then cooked low in that crock pot all day long with bay leaf and some spices. And to me, I don't think it ever comes out gamey, but again, I grew up eating venison. And I do think it might be a bit of acquired taste, but I know kids that used to come to my house as a kid, they never knew that that's all we ate in our family. So I think sometimes it's also a mental thing, but getting used to that. And so that's my favorite recipe.
That's awesome.
You also can't go wrong with butter.
you can never go wrong with butter. Stews, chilies. Those are my favorite. It's crock pot season at this point. So to me, lots of low and slow cooking. A Dutch oven is also great. I just love like hearty soups when it's like so dark, so early, basically.
That sounds delicious. And I haven't had lunch yet. So now I'm extremely hungry. We're going to take
a molasses cookie. So
you're killing me. Let's go now to Michael in Windsor. Michael, you are on the air.
Hi. I have a couple of questions. Well, actually, one main one is about how do you recommend preserving things like wild mushrooms? I love collecting wild mushrooms, and I usually give them away. I'm interested in education. And sometimes people ask me about the best way to, let's say, dry the mushrooms. And do you have any specific recommendations I could pass on to them, or commercial dryers or other methods? So, and then the other thing is, when I was listening to your comments about truffles, I realized I love matsutake mushrooms, but I love smelling them. And so this year I found some, and a friend found some and offered them to me. And all I wanted to do was inhale their fragrance and then give them back. And
so, I'm curious, what is it about the smell that you enjoy so much?
Well, you know what? It's that mystery of it. To me, it smells like some cinnamon and anise. And I don't know. I think what it is what you alluded to in some of your comments, that there was a time when I was first discovering matsutakes and that fragrance was there, and it was such a good memory. I think it stayed with me. And so I'm fully satisfied now if I just can smell them and then pass them on to other people so they can enjoy them and start their own journey with matsutakes. And when I gave some to my friend and former student, we talked about how she might dry them. And so I told her about some dryers, but I thought you all might have good recommendation for ways to preserve mushrooms.
Yeah, I bet our expert panel does. Thanks so much for your call, Michael. Pete, what are your suggestions for drying and preserving mushrooms?
Well, ideally, I personally like to eat them right away, but if you can't do that, the best way to preserve their quality is to kind of saute them up in a little bit of fat, either butter or oil, and then freeze them right away. And that way they kind of maintain their quality and their essence. My other go-to is dehydrating them. I like dehydrating them because I can fit a lot of mushrooms in a small space. And dehydrated mushrooms are great for soups and stews. And the other day we made quiche with them and risotto. So I would say dehydration or sauteing a little fat and then freezing is the best way.
And Jesse, do you have any suggestions there?
I agree with what he said. I would also say mushroom jerky is a great way to not, you know, just do the run-of-the-mill dehydration and saving dried food, but to add some flavor and, you know, a nice little snack.
That's
also, after dehydrating, you can grind up mushrooms and add that to, like, different soups and stews. It really gives, like, a nice burst of umami to the dish that you put it in, whether it's a stew or soup, what have you.
That sounds delicious. Now, I'd love to go around to each of you. Since the Thanksgiving holiday is coming up, and generally just a lot of family gatherings are in the works this fall and winter right now, I would love for each of you to share a dish that you think would be a good one that could highlight these types of local ingredients we've talked about that would be good for a big family dinner on a cold night. So, Kelly, let's start with you.
I'm going to go with the chili again, with just the crock potting and the low, slow cooking stuff, because really, like, the day before Thanksgiving, that's your big meal. It's the time when my family comes together and we're cooking up a lot of our traditional items. But the day before is usually around hunting and you're going out and you don't want to do a lot of cooking. So we usually do a really delicious chili with venison. Use the venison, ground up venison for it. And then any like beans that you might have grown that year and dried or purchased locally, black beans, kidney beans, and creating just a really delicious chili for that day before and as for leftovers. So that usually gets eaten right up.
Peter, what's your favorite dish for the holidays, and what goes into it? Did we lose you, Peter? All right, let's go to Jim.
Oh, sorry about that. I forgot I was on mute.
Technology's tough, but we got you.
So in terms of foraged dishes, I would definitely go with the wild mushroom risotto, and then maybe make a high bush cranberry sort of gastrique on top, and use some homemade chicken stock and keep it pretty simple. Maybe some thyme.
What is a gastrique? Is that what you said? Excuse my ignorance.
Yeah, gastrique is kind of like a fancy sweet and sour sauce. So you start off by making a caramel, and then you add vinegar and whatever flavors you want into that. So herbs and in this case, I would do the high bush cranberry. And it's a nice addition to something rich in umami.
And Jesse, what about you?
Well, I don't celebrate Thanksgiving. You know, the narrative of Thanksgiving needs to be changed, but you know, I do like to gather with my family if I can. We do a community meal here at Sweetwater's, so my day is tied up feeding the community. But I would probably this year going to do a venison shank for when I get home, because I don't want to see turkey when I get home.
That is fair. And thank you for highlighting that complex and often very painful narrative around Thanksgiving, and something that, you know, all Vermonters should keep in mind this time of year. Though many of us are spending time with our families right now and having those big big dinners together on cold nights. Now we got a message from Amanda who asked specifically if Pete the forager, she said, would be willing to take a group out in South Royalton to forage. So Pete, do you and Jesse, I would also love to hear from you. Do you take groups out to teach them about foraging and local plants?
I haven't yet. I've just done it with myself or my friends. But that is something that I would love to do. I love talking about mushrooms and learning more from other people who found other mushrooms.
And Jesse, what about you?
Now, when it comes to this education piece, Peter, I'm curious, because you are a forager, if you would, and in the vein of taking a group out, would you be willing to take me and Michaela out at some point so we can put to rest a bet of who can cook foraged food better?
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to do that.
I am convinced that my dish will be better than hers.
Oh, all right. We are on. We will be making a video of this and sharing it.
All come to my house. I would like you all to come to my house and cook all these things that we're discussing here.
Absolutely. I mean,
especially
I will use
Pete the forager.
Yes. Kelly, I promise I will use all of the tricks you've taught me today of low and slow and lots of butter.
Yes, or any kind of oil. The key with the venison is that it is very lean, and so you need to add a little bit of that oil or fat or something back in to give it a little bit more zhuzh and not to overcook it.
Can I add something to that?
Yes. Please.
Bear fat.
Bear fat. We did get to bear fat, did we?
Second that.
Yeah.
I second the bear fat.
For everything. Popcorn, searing, seasoning, bear fat.
All right, something to learn about soon. But unfortunately, that is all the time that we have today. We had Kelly Notterman with the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund and Vermont Farm to Plate, Peter Bayless, a chef and forager in South Royalton, and Jesse Lawyer, a Missisquoi Abenaki chef based in Burlington. Thanks to everyone for joining us today.